Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 16 of What's It Like? My guest today is Rob Potroff. Is that how you would say it?
No, you know what? I can't even pronounce it, so don't feel bad. It's Potorf, and it's Potorf. An old German name. Yep. Actually, our real German name is Botdorf, B-A-T-D-O-R-F, but I guess when we came over on the boat, they walked up and said your name, and we went Botdorf, and they just kind of looked at us strange, went, yeah, whatever. Okay, Potorf it is. So.
My family's name was Hansen in Norway, and my grandfather apparently didn't like that, and so he changed it to Tangen, which nobody can say. So we have changed it, Americanized it to Tangen, just because so somebody might be able to possibly understand what
actually,
we're saying.
I went to school with a friend of mine whose last name was Tangen, so I'm very familiar with it.
You live in the East Coast. Did you grow up on the East Coast?
Actually, I was born and raised a Midwest kid, you know, corn-fed in Ohio. Left when I got out of school and never turned back. I lived on the West Coast for a little bit in Santa Clara and then moved back to the East Coast, actually moved to Baltimore with a production company there. Ended up coming back to Cincinnati and then ended up in Charlotte, North Carolina, and now I'm in Lexington, Kentucky. So now I split my time between Lexington and L.A.
I don't know a lot about geography. Lexington, Kentucky doesn't seem to me like the center of music for film and television.
No, it's about as far away as you can possibly get. But I worked for Paramount for 11 years, Paramount Parks. I was their senior music composer. And they transferred us to Charlotte, North Carolina in 1993 because they wanted an East Coast connection. And they built a giant scene shop there. And it was sort of their East Coast connection for film production. And So they put the Paramount Parks corporate office there. So I was a senior music composer. I was in charge of the five parks here in the U.S. and Canada. And I wrote shows and for all the live show division and then for all the attractions and ride simulators and things like that. So that was primarily my role for 11 years.
That's a pretty broad range of projects to work on.
Yeah, I called it boot camp, composer's boot camp. If you could survive that, you can survive anything. And what was interesting about the job is when I originally got it, I was just hired as a music director and to also write for the stage shows. And over time, you know, I started creating a new element for Paramount Parks, which was basically creating a studio and a MIDI studio and a new way of actually arranging and writing shows. And I sort of brought them in kicking and screaming into the 21st century with the advent of computers and sequencing and synthesizers and samplers and things like that. And so what started off as a tiny little room behind the receptionist desk there in the corporate office ended up being a full-fledged division, which I ended up heading up for the last 5 years of my career with that company. And what was interesting about it is that, a lot of people ask, do you have to wait for the creative muse to hit you? And it's like, well, when you work for a company like that, you get in at 8 o'clock, you flip the light on, and you become creative for the next 9 to 12 hours. And so any given day you'd walk in and you'd be working on a country show for the first part of the day, and then you'd have to switch over to a Las Vegas style Broadway show for the second half of the day. And then you'd end up the night writing charts for a Hanna-Barbera Fred Flintstone show. So it was great training. And, you didn't have time to think about it. If you didn't do your job, you didn't have a job. So you had no choice in the matter.
I think they call that motivation.
Absolutely. A paycheck's a great motivator.
When you began, were you composing on paper?
Yes, actually I was. And what was interesting about that, I actually drug them once again into the 21st century using Finale as a notation software. And this was when Finale first came out. This was in 1988, I guess, 88 or 89.
It was pretty clunky, but it was the best thing I'd ever seen.
Oh, my God. I was ready to throw my computer out the window for like the first year and a half. In fact, I was one of the first people. My serial number, I remember it to this day, my serial number for Finale was 000566. So I was the 566th person to ever get Finale. So I suffered through those early years and believing that it would actually, you know, become a good program. Eventually it did, and it really, really sped up our production aspect of scoring and notation and things like that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, basically when you're doing those kind of shows, you're just, it's, I call it stream of consciousness writing. You're just going and you're writing. And once you get that done, then you can hand it down to an assistant. It's not uncommon of what happens in the film industry today. You get your sequence done, you hand it down, and then they extract that out into, you know, a conductor score or parts or whatever. It certainly saves a lot of time. You can just continue on writing.
When you are writing, do you use like the Nashville notation system, or do you do it note by note?
Oh, no, by no. Yeah, no Nashville notation, because basically in those days, we were still using live orchestra for everything, along with some sequence tracks, especially for the stage show. I would score for, you know, full orchestra for that. It ended up where we started incorporating a click track with some synth stuff, some bells and things like that. And you have to understand, too, that was in the late 80s and early 90s when, you know, a really cool synthesizer would be a Proteus, which most people won't know what that is. But for musicians out there, they're probably laughing right now. So, you know, to augment with certain sounds with a live orchestra was kind of a novel concept, especially in a theme park. And so, yeah, it was all live orchestra and full notation.
Well, my first love was Fender Rhodes, so.
No, absolutely. I had the stage Fender Rhodes, yes, when I was a kid. Of absolutely.
Yes.
We all did.
Yes.
In fact, I have a funny story about the Fender Rhodes. I went to Ohio University, and I played with the OU Jazz Ensemble. And this was way back in the Stone Age, and they did, the music department did not have a Fender Rhodes. And I don't know if they wanted me to play with them because I was good or because I had a Fender Rhodes, but, you know, I didn't care. At least I got to play with the jazz ensemble. But we had rehearsal twice a week. So twice a week, I'd have to carry that thing down two flights of steps, put it in my car, drive across campus, drag it into the music building, go up another flight of stairs to the rehearsal hall, and that's where we would have jazz ensemble practice two times a week. So I actually went from being a 98-pound weakling to, you know, 102-pound strongman. So
for those who don't understand the technology of a Fender Rhodes, it was actually like little tuning forks inside of a big box that you carried under your arms.
Yeah, and they put bricks in it, too.
Yes,
I'm pretty sure of
that. So if you dropped it, those little things wouldn't stay in tune. They would move, or they would shatter, yeah, or some other things.
Well, and the beauty of it these days is that, you know, it's on my computer. I have,
yes,
Native Instruments Fender Rhodes, and it's just, it's gorgeous, and it sounds exactly like what I had when I was young.
Yeah.
So it's great. And it's a lot lighter.
Yes, it certainly is. When you were growing up, aside from your Fender Rhodes, what was your favorite childhood possession?
Well, I mean, I actually started playing when I was 5 years old, and my parents got me a toy ukulele for my fifth Christmas, and, you know, it was that proverbial, you know, fish to water, and it had a little chord-o-matic on it, and I learned to, it had buttons, you know, for G chord, you'd hit the G button, and it would put these little felt fingers down inside this little box that was on the ukulele neck, and it would create a G chord. And so I learned to play that, and I started learning my little Sunday school songs. And one Sunday I was, you know, scheduled to sing in my church, and the Saturday night before, the chord-o-matic broke. So, you know, crushed, I was forced to learn how to actually play the thing. So, you know, at 5 years old, I started playing the ukulele and took to that. And they bought, when I started growing a little bit, I got a baritone uke, which was a little bit bigger. And when I started growing a little bit more, I finally got a guitar and learned to play the guitar. And, you know, did what every other kid did, took lessons and the whole nine yards. And then at 9 years old, it's kind of a silly story, but the serial alphabets at that time, remember in the days where they would put the 45 record on the back of the cereal box and you would cut it out?
Ah, yes.
The little plastic ones. Well, the Archies was big at that time. So there was a little record called Sugar Sugar. And I got that off, and I remember cutting it and playing it. I thought that was the coolest thing. I was like eight years old, and played it. And all of a sudden I got the bright idea, you know what? That's not a difficult song. I can do that. So I wrote my first song at 8 years old. And, you know, started then and started writing tunes and started writing, you know, kind of instrumental kind of things. And it went from there. And at 15, I decided I wanted to play the piano. So I just started playing the piano.
You sat down and taught yourself?
Yeah, exactly. You know, if I was given the gift of anything, I was given the gift of having a good ear. So it helped me out a lot when I was young.
The nice thing about a piano is you push the note down and you always get the same note.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
So it's at least predictable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And well, and the thing for me, what really opened up my world was, I think it was my sophomore, junior year. It was close to when I started playing piano. I wasn't in the band, but the band director, John Blevins, who was also the orchestra director, teacher there, a brilliant guy, great arranger, and we're still friends to this day. He was taking a bunch of kids to go see a jazz concert. And I hadn't been introduced to jazz. I mean, you have to understand, I come from the back sticks of Ohio. And so he was taking some kids from the music department over to Columbus to see a jazz concert. And he said, "Do you want to go?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure." So I went with him, had no idea what jazz was. Well, my first introduction to jazz back in the 70s was when Buddy Rich walked out on stage and his big band played and went crazy. And I just was blown away. And then after that, it was a back-to-back show and Maynard Ferguson walked out.
Wow.
So that was my first introduction to jazz. And from that point forward, it was pretty much all downhill for me. I was hooked. So jazz was a main influence in my younger days.
Which instrument did you pick to pursue in jazz?
Piano all the way. There was just something about, you know, improvisation and chordal structure and voicings that just was amazing to me. I mean, you have, you know, chordal structure and voicing in guitar, but for some reason the piano just really spoke to me, and I just immersed and drowned myself in it. Loved it.
Is there a point when you began to think in orchestra?
Yeah, I mean, it was primarily always there. But as far as application, it wasn't until probably my early 20s that, you know, I started really hearing things in my head, so to speak. You know, a lot of guys will talk about that.
Right.
Now, as far as being applicable and being able to execute, it still wasn't at that point yet. But later on, you know, a few years down the road is when I, you know, got a chance to actually start doing some charts and experimenting around. And that sort of prepped me to get the job with Paramount and start doing shows. And to be honest with you, when I got the job with Paramount, I really wasn't well versed yet. So, you know, all of a sudden I find myself in the studio producing at that point behind the desk. And I was just, all of a sudden, I'm listening to other music directors that were on staff there, listening to their arrangements and going, "Oh my God, okay, I got to soak this up fast." So it was sort of one of those, you just sort of jump in the deep end and do it. And that was sort of how it worked for me.
Is there some arranger that you particularly emulated or followed?
Well, you know, it's funny. There were a couple guys that were on staff there actually three people that I really listened to their arrangements, did analysis on their charts and their scores, and really kind of figured it out. And one was Scott Woolley, who's just an amazing, amazing pianist arranger. He does a lot of stuff on Broadway and things like that. Another one is Terry LeBolt, who's actually a music professor at IU. And the other one was Bruce Fisher, who was actually head of the music department for King's Productions / Paramount Parks for a long, long, long time. And Bruce used me a lot in the early days. As I'm also a vocalist, and he used me as a studio singer. And that's where my sight reading chops really got, you know, doing that, because, you know, you'd walk in for, you know, a 4 to 6 hour session, and especially for the theme park shows, and he'd throw charts down in front of you and you had to sight read that stuff. And if you didn't, man, he would let you know it. And to this day, I listen to his arrangements, and I'm blown away by how good he was and is. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's still doing it. All three of those guys had a huge, huge impact on me.
As a singer, I always thought that sight reading was particularly difficult, but it's only one line. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to sight read piano or something, that's a lot of lines to keep track of all at once.
It really is. And, you know, and I'm the first to admit that I'm a terrible piano sight reader. And it's something that I don't do a lot of because I spend my time writing this stuff instead of reading it. I did get fairly competent at it as when I was working for Paramount. And, you know, I'd go in to teach the shows. And when you're teaching, you know, four or five parts to a group of kids, I mean, you get pretty good at, you know, sight reading this stuff down. So for, you know, 5 or 6 year period, you know, I felt pretty comfortable with it and actually got pretty good at it. But these days, it's just not something that I do. And if, you know, it's that old saying, if you don't use it, you kind of lose it. So I do drag out, you know, piano scores every once in a while and just to try to make sure that I don't look like a total idiot if I have to go.
So in your profession, who is the most famous person you've encountered?
James Horner. Actually, in 2004, I was involved with a film called Bobby Jones, Stroke of Genius. And James Horner did the score with it. I originally was up to do the score, and all of a sudden the film got a bigger budget and I got bumped. So, which is the hazard of the business, as most guys that are at my level know about.
That's pretty common, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very common. Very common. You know, the cool thing about it was that, you know, I got to do all the trailers for the film, the trailers that ended up being in the theater. And this was, you know, prior to me doing any films that actually made it to film or in the theaters or Redbox or any of those. So at the time, that was a big deal for me to actually be doing a feature trailer for the theaters.
Oh, yeah.
And then on top of that, the producers, you know, they appreciated what I was doing. They liked my work. And they said, listen, you know, if you'd like to, we'd love to have you come out to L.A. We're going to be recording a Todd Ayo out at CBS. You know, James is going to be doing everything. We'd like to have you out there for 3 days. And I was like, you don't have to ask why. So I went out and, you know, I got to meet somebody that I always looked up to and love his music and his scoring abilities and everything about it. And it was just very cool. It was 3 days of just sitting in Todd A. Studios, whether it was behind in the control room or actually going out sitting, you know, in the main hall with the orchestra. And that was a cool thing because he had a 110-piece orchestra for that film. And it was just such a huge sound. And
wow.
But the good thing about that was is that it made me realize that I was nowhere near being ready to score a film. Wasn't even close. And that's important because, you know, I saw everything that went on behind the scenes and was like, okay, I've got a lot to learn. And so for 3 days, I mean, I was like a sponge just watching, observing, you know, anything from the guy that was, you know, running the time code and click track to the engineer, to the producers, to whatever was going on. And let me tell you, years later now, it certainly makes a difference in the way that I approach a film.
When you score for a movie and you have 110 in your orchestra, do they all show up at once or do you do section by section?
Well, it depends. It depends on the cues. For example, if, you know, for the main cues that require everybody, yeah, everybody's there. They may do some overdubs for, let's say you have some ethnic reeds or something like that, or maybe ethnic string, like a triangle or something like that. That could be something that's done at a later time. But normally everything's done at once. Then if you have other cues that require a smaller section, you'll schedule those. For example, like maybe day one will be all orchestra. Then day two in the morning, you may have cues, you know, M17, 26, and 34, which are a smaller section. So only those people come in. And then after lunch, everybody else comes in. So it just, that's where it gets real tricky on time management as far as studio time goes, blowing money.
Now, in some CDs, when they're recording that, don't they have, they'll have the strings come in and do the string part, and then later on they'll have somebody else do it, and over time they will build up their sound, rather than having them all come at once?
Yeah, I mean, that happens too. And a lot of times that depends on the budget of the film. For example, if you don't have, you know, $160,000 to $250,000 to spend on, you know, recording a 45-minute score, you may have to break that down and hire, let's say, 17 to 21-piece string section and bring them in and then double-track them so you have a larger section. And then you may bring your brass in, and usually you don't try to double-track brass because you have some phase albums and things like that. But it just all depends on the budget of the film. You know, the coup de grace for any composer is to be able to have a nice enough budget just to bring everybody in and record it and move on.
Well, and how much fun.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. There's nothing better. Let me preface it by saying I love technology. I love the sample-based orchestras that are out there because it's instant gratification. It's instant feedback. You can hear what you're doing, what it's going to end up like. The producers and the directors love it because they can hear exactly what it's going to sound like. Mm-hmm. You know, you do a mock-up and, you know, they can hear exactly what it's like. But that being said, there is nothing like laying your charts down in front of a bunch of players and hearing them play that back for you. It's just, it's the ultimate high. I can't even explain.
Do you remember the first time that you heard somebody playing your music?
Oh, yeah, it was with Paramount. And it was one of the stage shows that I had written. And, you know, when you hear, and this goes back to exactly what you were talking about a couple seconds ago. We would bring in string section first and record all the strings, and then we'd bring in brass, and then we'd bring in reeds, or maybe brass and reeds at the same time, but we would do them in sections. And I remember the first session I did that was my charts, and, you know, your palms are sweaty, and you're just going, oh, my God, I hope I wrote in harmonically correct so the string players don't start slamming their bows on the music stands and things like that. But when they started playing, it was just, it's one of those feelings that I never want to forget. It was most, yeah, pretty cool.
If life had been different, what would you have become?
You know what? If I don't know, I'd probably end up in a cardboard box under an overpass somewhere because honestly, I don't know how to do anything else. I'm a complete moron when it comes to anything else other than music.
Well, it's a good thing you ended up where you did.
Yeah, thank you. The only other thing that I would have wanted to do in my life, and this is going to sound crazy, there are actually two things that, you know, I want to do. I play a lot of tennis, and in my younger days, I played a lot of tournament competition, and I always wanted to be a professional tennis player like all young guys do. You know, obviously, that didn't work out because, funny enough, I wasn't good enough. But the other thing was, I always wanted to be a naval aviator. Yeah, it's just crazy. It's one of those things that's completely out of the blue, but I'm a big military history buff. I love World War II history, aviation history, all that stuff. It's totally random, but yeah, that's me.
Ever since Top Gun.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, my father was a World War II vet. He served in the South Pacific, and I think it stemmed from him telling me stories when I was a kid, as he actually saw MacArthur land. Yeah, he saw the whole thing. And so all the stories that he told me as a kid really kind of interest me as far as that era in time. So to this day, I mean, my wife laughs at me because, you know, at night she'll lean over and say, okay, good night, and wait till I'm asleep until you turn on the military channel. Like,
So your dad was in the Philippines?
Yes, he was. He was in the Gulf of Leyte, is where MacArthur landed.
Yes.
And and he was, it was a night after a battle that they had, and he said him and a bunch of his buddies, he was a motorman, and they were up on the deck, and they were all kind of sunning themselves because it was actually a calm day, morning, and they saw this PT boat come into the bay there, and people jumped out, and they were far enough away they really couldn't see detail, but they could see they were setting stuff up on the beach. And then the boat took off after, you know, an hour or so and left, and then he said a few hours later, here comes this PT boat with the flags and the whole nine yards, and everybody was on the beach and things were set up, and it pulled up and there was MacArthur jumping off.
Ah, wow.
Yep.
We'll have more with Rob right after this, right after I remind you of the good work being done by the American Red Cross. If you ever need an operation, you'll be glad that people donated blood to help you. So I want to remind you to give blood and to donate to the American Red Cross. Somewhere in the world today, there are people you can help through the Red Cross. Do yourself a favor. Give to the American Red Cross. Go to redcross.org. Thanks. So, Rob, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
The biggest motivation for me is just kind of thinking that I'm blessed and grateful for what I do. You know, we all do projects or we all do work or whatever that even if you love it, at times you're like, ugh. Do I have to really do this? And, you know, I mean, there have been projects that I just feel like that I'm just going through the motions, or it's, you know, I don't want to do this or everything. But every time I get to that point, I have to stop and think, listen, you're not digging ditches for a living. You're actually creating something. You're writing music. I mean, how many people would give anything to have an opportunity to do something like that? So, you know, it's just one of those things that it's like with anything in life. You have to be grateful for what you have. You know, I'm so grateful for my family. I have just a beautiful, loving wife, Chris, two great kids, Luke and Haley, that make me proud on a daily basis. When I don't want to kill them. No, I'm just kidding. No. They're great. Luke is 18. Haley is 16. Luke's getting ready to go away to college. Oh, wow. And
Big changes.
Huge changes. And, you know, it's just those things that you have to keep life into perspective. And, you know, your perspective is your family. That's what's important. So, so as far as motivation, I get to do this every day for a living. I'm one of the lucky guys that actually can make a living out of this stupid business.
When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself?
I have two things. I like to run and I like to ride my Harley. Those are my two things.
One sounds rather quiet and Buddhistic, and the other rather not.
Well, the other one is sort of Buddhistic also, but in a different way. You have to understand that it's nice to go out on a back road and just get on your motorcycle and just ride. You have the wind. I mean, it's that old cliche, the wind through your hair. Just have not a care in the world, and there's something very cathartic about getting on a motorcycle and just riding
and,
by yourself.
And do you say "om" as you're going down there?
Well, yeah, I have to leave the little finger things out because I wipe out. But yeah, there's a little "om" in there every once in a while. The other thing for me too is to actually come down here in the studio and just turn on the piano and just play for a little bit, and. You know, it's just very calm and relaxing, and knowing that you're not having to write something for a particular project, you're just kind of freestyle, and just it's that's very cathartic also.
Did you say turn on the piano?
Yeah. I know, it's weird. We have a baby grand upstairs, and I rarely ever touch it because down here I can put headphones on and just go crazy. Yeah. And that's one thing for me, especially when I'm writing, is that a lot of times I'll put headphones on because I feel more comfortable knowing that the outside world can't hear me tinkering around and trying to figure out what I'm doing musically.
And no one hears your mistakes.
Exactly. I just, it's just one of those, I'm sure I could get over that with therapy, but it's always been that way for me. I have to have my own space.
Headphones are cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trust me.
What kind of headphones do you use?
You know, I'm using Bose headphones, and they're very flat response, and you know, they sound good. I don't use them to mix with, obviously, but they've got a nice low end to them, so it's kind of nice to write with.
Do you work at home for most of your job?
Yeah, it's funny. For the last 6 years, I've had my studio in my home because once I really started doing a lot more television, not as much film, but television, I all of a sudden discovered that deadlines didn't wait for you. So I'd end up, you know, staying at my studio, which was always off site, till 1 or 2 in the morning, and then having to get up early to get back in to, you know, try to get stuff done to hit a deadline. And at that point I thought, you know what, as soon as my lease is up on this place, my next one, I'm going to build in the house. So, I was living in Charlotte, North Carolina at the time, and, I had a basement, an unfinished basement. So I decided, you know what, I've always wanted to be a carpenter and build. So I go ahead and build out this basement. So I framed the whole thing and insulated and did the whole nine yards and built my own studio, my composition studio in my home. And I would never have it any other way. I have a composition studio in my home here in Lexington. And, you know, I love it. The house is big enough that, you know, I actually go downstairs and go to my studio and go to work. And at the end of the day, I can turn the lights off and actually go back up and join the rest of the world. So, yeah.
So for the geeks with us, what constitutes a studio for you?
I have a couple for visual playback. I have a full 10x20 projection system. that I use every once in a while. But I have a 48-inch LED screen for video and film. And then I have a Genelec surround system. Genelec, for anybody who doesn't, Genelec's one of the nicer studio monitoring systems out there. Mm-hmm. Surround system 5.1, so I can write in 5.1.
Is television done in 5.1 typically?
Well, it's getting there. If you listen to a lot of the network series that are on, I think 24 was doing music in 5.1. But it's becoming the norm now. And it's actually becoming the norm now for film also. So, what was great when I first converted this over to 5.1, I put in up on my computer one of the synths that I have. And put a 5.1 delay on it, hit a note, and it bounced all around the room. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. I can't wait to do a film in 5.1. So, it's like Christmas for geeks. But, so my studio, I have my full 5.1 surround. It's all acoustically designed. I have a console. And you can go on my website and see the studio itself. And I have remote lighting on the console so I can bring the lights up and down as I need, as I'm writing. I have to have the creature comforts because it's all about the aesthetics of the room. And, the more it feels like home and the more it feels like a cocoon or a musical womb, so to speak, the better it is for me. So.
Do you typically write on a synthesizer or do you use the mouse and keyboard?
Well, I have a keyboard controller. It's an 88 key controller, and I've actually had this for, I got it back in 89. It's a Roland A80, and the reason I love it, it doesn't have as many controller knobs on it as I wish it did. However, the feel of it, it's a hammer action feel, and it's the closest to a real piano that I've ever felt on any controller keyboard. So that's why I continue to use it. And in fact, it's funny, I'll get on eBay every once in a while and see if there's another one out there because I want to buy another one just for parts. So when things start falling apart on this, I can actually replace it because I don't think I'll ever go to anything else unless there's something out there better. But and then in the other room, all of my computers and everything are in a totally separate room. So
nice.
Yeah, so this room is totally isolated and quiet. So if I want to record any guitar parts or anything, this is basically like an isolation room also.
Mm-hmm. Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to your core?
Oh, interesting that you would ask it. Back in 2003, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And that certainly stops you in your tracks and gives you a bit of pause. And I was actually doing an animation series at the time. And I'd been having some headaches and some balance problems and things like that. And I played on I love sports and I've always played sports since I was a kid. And I was playing on a couple different softball leagues in that 2-year period. And the one season I was playing center field and, I'd get a fly ball and I played since I was a kid. It was no big deal, routine. And all of a sudden it would go over my head and my depth perception was just really screwed up. And I just thought it was because I was getting older. And so finally, to make a long story short, which I'm way beyond that, I went into my practitioner and he ran some tests and things like that and did a cranial x-ray. And he told me later on he knew what it was. But he said, let's do this. Let's order an MRI and we'll eliminate the obvious and then we'll get you with a migraine specialist. I said, okay. So at that time in 2003 in Charlotte, there weren't that, even though it's a big medical community. I mean, it's one of the best in the nation. The city itself didn't have that many MRI machines. And so I had to wait like, I think, 7 days before I got scheduled for an MRI. And so it was a Friday night. I had a 9 o'clock MRI. I was actually doing charts. I was recording orchestra that Monday for this animation thing that I was doing. And I had gotten, halfway through and I looked at the clock and it was 15 till. Okay, so I ran up the street to the technician and I jumped in the machine and long and short of it, they never let me go home. Mm. Immediately put me in the hospital, and that was Saturday, and Tuesday morning I was rolling in, and they were cutting my head open and taking out a brain tumor the size of a small orange.
What part of the brain was it located in?
It was in the occipital lobe, and it was called a hemangioblastoma, which is a benign tumor. It's a vascular tumor. The good news about it was that it's a benign tumor. The bad news is it's very vascular, so you know, a high percentage of people buy it on the operating table. Well, I had one of the best neurosurgeons in the country, and he did a phenomenal job and took care of it. And the bad news was is that a couple of days afterwards, I had an aneurysm on the other side of my brain, which kept me in for an additional period of time. I was only supposed to be in for 4 days. And that kept me in for a little more than a week. And the night before I was to be released, I started getting a headache again. And all of a sudden I crashed and I contracted spinal meningitis. So my little 4 day event ended up being almost an entire month. So that was one of those life changing moments that after I survived all of that, my perspective on life changed drastically. And the things that would bother me before or the things that I would get frustrated with really had no meaning or importance from that point forward. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that if I had to do over again, I would not like to do it. But you know what? In a strange way, it's kind of a blessing that it happened because it gave me a new insight on A, myself, and B, just life in general. And, you know, just to be able to appreciate the things that are around you and to be able to look at things that are happening and remembering. I mean, because we go through life, a lot of times we go through life where you don't pay attention to what's going around you. And, you know, years down the road, you're like, gosh, I wish I would have paid more attention when I was doing such and such. I make it a point every day to try to absorb everything that I'm doing and enjoy the ride. You've got to enjoy the ride.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would be your best advice? What would you say?
I would give the advice that my father gave me. I didn't go to college right away when I first got out of high school because, you know, I was sure I was going to be a pop star, you know, like every young musician. I had my band and the whole nine yards. So my parents were open-minded enough and they were willing to give me a couple of years to, you know, kind of work on my music and experiment and do all this stuff, which I'm glad they did. But at the time, you know, I needed a job and my grades were pretty good in high school. So I remember I got a job as a bank manager trainee, which is code for teller. And I got the job as a teller and I absolutely hated it. Oh my God. It was the worst job in the entire universe. And I apologize to anyone that works in the banking industry and then does teller work because for the people that enjoy it, I mean, it's wonderful, but I hated it. And I remember I came out one morning, I was getting ready for work and my dad was sitting at the breakfast table and he looked at me and was like, "What's wrong, son?" And I said, "I just hate this job. I can't stand blah, 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 blah." And he looked at me and said, "Listen, if I can tell you anything, and if you don't remember anything I ever say, remember this, do what makes you happy." He said, "As long as you can feed your family, pay your bills, and keep the creditors off your back, that's pretty much what's important. Just be happy." And so 2 weeks later, I quit my job. But I live by that every day. You know, I mean, when I talk to our son, Luke, it's like, you know, he wants to be an orthopedic surgeon. And, you know, I tell him, whatever you do, do it with gusto, do it with 150%, but be happy with it because you can't do something you don't like to do for the rest of your life. There are too many people out there that are living that nightmare every day. And I just, you know, I feel for them. I can't imagine getting up every day and having to go do something that I don't want to do because I did that for a short period of time. So that's another reason I'm so grateful for what I do. Somewhere in there would be a commencement speech, but that would be the primary message.
The last question is to help me become better at this process. So if there was a defining moment in your life that we haven't talked about, what question should I have asked to get you to tell that story?
What made you decide you want to be a film composer?
So, Rob, what made you decide to become a film composer?
Well, you know, I'd always been interested in movies and film and always loved the music. And I loved the way that it guided you on how to feel without, you know, grabbing you by the nose and leading you. So that was always there, but the defining moment for me was in 82 or 83. I can't remember exactly when it was. I was sitting in a darkened theater seeing E.T. for the first time. And at the end of that film, when John Williams does this huge swelling crescendo, orchestral crescendo, and the mother, you know, the little boy gets off the ship and she just falls to her knees. I, even now talking about it, I'm, you know, it sounds weird, but I kind of get cold chills about it. That moment, I was like, I have to do this. I don't know how, but I have to do this. And, you know, that was sort of the impetus of my journey to eventually get to what I'm doing at this point. And, you know, and I'm nowhere near being to where I want to be, but, you know, I'm doing film and television. How bad can that be?
Well, I guess you are then where you want to be.
Sort of. Sort of. But you know what? Anybody in the creative arts, you're never as good as you want to be, and you're never as far as you got to be.
Well, it's good to have goals, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Rob. Thanks so much for joining me, and I appreciate it.
Ken, I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.